If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. Give the active people in your life something they'll truly appreciate. Performance apparel from Vuori. Whether they're into running, surfing, hiking, or even just casual walks around the block, there's something for everyone. And if you're not sure what to gift them, you can't go wrong with something from Vuori's Dream Knit collection. It's the perfect gift and so comfortable. Get 20% off your first purchase today at Vuori, Vuori.com/Spotify.
Today, Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast, fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. The people of the ancient Greek city-state of Sparta have left an indelible mark on history. Celebrated for the 300s against the odds resistance to the Persians at Thermopylae, famed for their austerity and fanatical devotion to military discipline, and criticised for their treatment of enslaved people. Spencer Mizzen sat down with the ancient historian Paul Cartledge to tackle your questions on the Spartans.
We're here to talk about the ancient city-state of Sparta. Now, thanks to its wars with Athens, its famously austere way of life, and of course, the Hollywood blockbuster 300. I think most of our listeners will know a little bit about the Spartans. They'll probably have a working knowledge of who the Spartans were. But to set the scene, I wonder if you could start by giving us a quick introduction to the Spartans. Who were they? And what were the chief milestones in the history of this city-state?
Hello, Spencer. Thank you for having me on your podcast. The Spartans are a mystery. I'm reminded of what Churchill said about Russia. They're a mystery wrapped in an enigma. And the reason for that is because the evidence for the ancient Spartans is remote and it's indistinct, shall we say. The main sources, main written sources, are non-Spartan. And they come in two forms. They're either very positive or they're very negative. So we historians have a slightly difficult task of choosing between extremely positive statements. And then you wonder, well, are they a bit exaggerated or even made up? And then on the other side, extremely negative sources from people who, thank goodness, they say to themselves, we're not Spartans, we're not like them. So you can probably understand what the impact or the effect of this, what's sometimes called the mirage of the ancient Spartans. It is that we have to try to discriminate between the positive and the negative. And what it presents the Spartans as is odd. as different. And there's a bit of a blowback among historians today trying to suggest that, well, they're not as odd as some of the ancient sources made out. So let me just put that in the background. Everything I say has to be qualified by that sort of understanding. So who were they and what were the chief milestones in the history of this city-state? Well, at their biggest, when they had achieved domination of their local area, they occupied the largest single territory in the whole of ancient Greece. Now, ancient Greece is not modern Greece. It's spread out. There were Greeks living all around the Mediterranean, all around the Black Sea. Sparta is in the southern part of mainland Greece in the Peloponnese, and its total territory after conquest, I'll come back to that, was something like 3,000 square miles, something like 8,400 square kilometers. The next biggest city-state was Syracuse in eastern Sicily, and that had only about 4,000 square kilometers. So you can see the difference, and that was the second biggest. We first encounter Sparta as a city-state in what we call the 8th century, so that's the 700s. And very soon they're on the warpath trying to conquer, first of all, peoples to their south. The settlement of Sparta is in the Eurotas Valley. The Eurotas goes out into the sea, into the Laconian Gulf, and the Spartans, first of all, spread south and southeast. They then spread more extraordinarily west and conquered what came to be called Messenia. And so they thereby doubled their territory, but also acquired a subject population of Greeks whom they enslaved. And this is me, and not everybody agrees with me, but to me, the key to understanding how ancient Sparta really was is their conquest and domination of a servile population of helots. I'll come back to helots later in another context. So by about, let's say, 600 BC, Sparta is Sparta. So big city, with lots and lots of subordinate Greeks called helots, plus people who weren't slaves but weren't Spartans either. So in other words, settlements in the territory of Sparta, within the vicinity of Sparta, but not Spartans. And that's very important because Sparta, to be a Spartan, you have to go through a rigorous system of training. And in order to become a fully Spartan, you have to undergo the agoge. We're going to come back to that. So there we have Sparta dominating the Peloponnese. It then starts to dominate outside the Peloponnese. Extraordinarily, it acquires an alliance. We call it the Peloponnesian League because most of the allies of Sparta were within the Peloponnese. And that was the organization which, in the early 5th century, so we're in the 400s, 490s, 480s, was the key to resisting major invasion of mainland Greece from the east, from Persian Empire. Sparta and its allies dominated the alliance, but crucially it included Athens. Sparta by land, Sparta the greatest military power by land, allied with Athens, greatest military power by sea, defeated the Persian attempt to conquer mainland Greece. And on the back of that, Greece flourished, mainland Greece, in the 5th century BC, in the 400s. Unfortunately, Sparta and Athens fell out. I can't go into all the reasons for that, but they had a major bust-up. And for the last third of the 5th century, from the 430s to the end of the 5th century, so the 400s, Sparta and Athens and its respective allies fought each other, and they fought each other almost to a standstill. It was a really bad moment, and Sparta won. Spartans, rather unfortunately, you could almost say stupidly, doubled down. They, having beaten the Athenians, they treated not only their defeated enemies, but also their allies in a very harsh way. And one of the former allies, the Boeotians, led by Thebes, rose up against their former ally Sparta and defeated them in battle in the 370s. That, to all intents and purposes, was the end of Sparta as a great power. Now, Sparta continued to exist, and in the Roman period, because the Romans conquered mainland Greece in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, Sparta became a kind of most favoured nation among the conquered Greeks. So Sparta in the Roman period has a flourishing in an odd sort of way. And at the same time, they presented themselves, the Spartans, as sort of a theme park of their great ancient days. So it's slightly fake that Sparta in the first, second centuries AD was actually quite a powerful, in terms of economically and socially and so on, cohesive and powerful place. But it was a shadow, if we look at it in the grand scheme of things, of its former self. The great period of Spartan history is the 6th century, that's the 500s, the 5th century, and the 4th century, between circa 600 and 350 BC.
Before delving into a lot of that in more detail, I wonder if we could just quickly rewind to the beginning with a question that was submitted to us on Instagram from Zolid there, and that is, how did Sparta become Sparta? Can you describe its rise to prominence?
When we're talking about, as I am now, the 10th, 9th, 8th centuries, those are the periods of its rise to prominence. And we're talking about mainly contemporary archaeological evidence. So a settlement on the banks of the Eurotas grows up such that we can document its existence in some detail through its sanctuaries, that it's its main religious shrines, by about 700 BC. After that, and this is a slight puzzle, so how was it that Sparta, having become Sparta, took it into its head that it wasn't enough to have all the territory on the eastern side of the Taygetos mountain chain, which rises up to about 8,000 feet, 2,400 meters, but they wanted more. They wanted territory on the western side of the Taygetos mountain chain. Why? No other Greek state that we know of went to such lengths to expand its territory and then, having expanded it, to hold it down. Now, you can, I think, immediately see that this has one major implication. Sparta has turned itself into a city of occupation, that its very essence, the nature of it, is conditioned by its choice to become not just a local city exploiting its regional territory, but to expand that territory to such an extent that it becomes a problem. And some people think that Sparta becomes a kind of military state, one would almost say, and of course the negative tradition says, an armed camp. So that's the situation. By about 700 BC, it's got the southern Peloponnese. It thereby is in a position, if it wishes, to expand further, and it does seem. In the now the 500s, the 6th century BC, it decides to go further north. And the territory bordering immediately on the territory of the Spartans is called Arcadia. And the Spartans attempt, but fail, to conquer the Greeks who are just living over the border. And that's a bit of a lesson to them, and they learn it quite wisely. It's better to expand your influence by diplomacy than it is to keep going on conquering physically. And that's the beginning of the Spartans' alliance, the so-called Peloponnesian League. And as I say, by 500, Sparta's top dog in really the whole of mainland Greece, partly because of its own home territory and the Helots who are working the land, and on the other hand, by its alliance with other Peloponnesian states.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/historyextra. Just go to Indeed.com/historyextra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. Give the active people in your life something they'll truly appreciate. Performance apparel from Vuori. Whether they're into running, surfing, hiking, or even just casual walks around the block, there's something for everyone. And if you're not sure what to gift them, you can't go wrong with something from Vuori's Dream Knit collection. It's the perfect gift and so comfortable. Get 20% off your first purchase today at Vuori, Vuori.com/Spotify.
Great stuff. Now, as we've already touched upon, the Spartans are known for their austerity, for their kind of refusal to let their hair down and embrace the finer things in life, as it were, and also for their fanatical discipline. But George Haig, writing in on social media, wants to know, were they really as ascetic as history has traditionally made them out to be? I mean, what was the philosophy that underpinned these beliefs?
Well, that's another good question, though. I wouldn't myself use the word philosophy of the Spartans, except in a very general sense, way of life, which the Spartans had chosen. And I put it that way because the Spartans are not noted for their theoretical interests or capacities. In other words, they're very pragmatic people, not sophisticated thinkers. So were they really as ascetic? Now, whether or not the question is aware, there is a big debate, and it's caused by the nature of the archaeological evidence that's been excavated. There is a flourishing in the 6th century, that is in the 500s, of a Sparta which seems not to be the Sparta of what I've called the mirage, the image of Sparta which is projected in the later sources. It's very, very, as you say, austere and ascetic. There seems to be a quite different Sparta in the 500s. And so it's possible that there is an actual change. In that period, the Spartans make the decision to become austere and to deny themselves what their situation, controlling all these slaves who are working away on the land, they are relatively well off. There's a surplus which could be put into the finer things of life. But it looks to me as if they've made a conscious decision. If we are to keep the helots down, we ourselves have to pare down our fineries, that we must not, in other words, allow ourselves to grow slack. We've got to be extremely fit, we've got to be constantly prepared for problems at home, and we must concentrate more on things of the military than of, if you like, private life. So public life triumphs over private life. It's a masculine, it's a collectivized, it's a centralized way of life to which the women of Sparta, and they acquire a certain fame as being devoted supporters of their husbands who actually go and fight and die, and their sons. The women of Sparta are, we have to assume, fully signed up to this way of life.
Do we know when the term Spartan entered the lexicon?
Well, the word Spartan is a modern, of course, English adjective. It's rather a complicated situation. The Spartans themselves called themselves both Spartiati, Spartiates, and they called themselves Lacedaemonians because that's the name of the territory that their whole city occupied, Lacedaemon. And Spartan, as we use it, is first used in Roman times, Spartanus, and it means, as you say, austere, ascetic, and that's the dominant impression that the Spartans themselves wanted to give, regardless of how actually or ascetic and austere every Spartan was. And I put it that way because there's some evidence that some Spartans were, shall we say, less austere than others, and that, in fact, they didn't abide by the collectivization and the extreme notion that everybody must devote themselves to the centralized collective communal ideal.
Sure. Now, underpinning the rise of Sparta was, of course, its military prowess. And that leads me on to a question that has been submitted by Chrono Historia on social media. And that is, can you tell us a little bit about the Agoge military training? How effective did this make their military?
The word agoge means upbringing or rearing. It doesn't actually occur until well after the peak that I've been speaking about, 6th, 5th, 4th centuries. The word doesn't appear until the 2nd century BC, so we can't be absolutely sure it's what the Spartans themselves would have used. However, what is a fact is that Sparta alone introduced and enforced a communal system of, well, education is putting it slightly wrong, I think. It's more like training or discipline. And the way it's described, again in a much later source, a man called Plutarch, following an earlier source called Xenophon, is that from the age of 7, boys were removed from their native home. So in other words, they are born and they grow up in a private household. But from the age of 7, they're the property of the state. And from the age of 7 to 18, they go through a system of education which is organized on a year-by-year basis. So you're in, as we say in our educational system today, year 1, year 2, and so on. And from the age of 18 on, there is a period of in-betweenness between being a child and being a fully adult member of the Spartan military, where they undergo specialized training, sort of like in the Boy Scouts, if I can put it like that, in order to find out whether people can survive on their own. Whereas from 7 to 18, they're totally supervised. And they did learn their letters. They did learn some maths. But above all, they learned to be obedient and they learned to be fit. And they were constantly tested as to how they were getting along. One part of the education was to be able to answer questions in a snappy way. And we have an adjective, laconic, and that comes directly from the ancient Spartans. And it means the ability to speak in a very short, pointed, snappy way. No long-winded answers like the one I'm giving you, Spencer, now. So the Spartans were trained to be laconic both in words and in deeds, and no other Greek city had any form of public, communal, collective, compulsory education in the way the Spartans did. And it's almost inevitable to connect that with the fact that Sparta was controlling this huge amount of territory with lots and lots of unfree Greeks, many of whom were not entirely thrilled to be the Spartans' slaves. You did ask me how effective did that make. Well, given that the Spartans didn't do any work, in other words, they were freed by the Helots from having to do what normal Greeks did, which was to farm the land, which is a very intensive sort of thing to do, they had lots of time to decide how to spend their, in a way, leisure. And so that's where training comes in. And so to the extent that the Spartans were able to train their young in the ways of the military from a very early age, they were in that sense in a better position than any other Greek state to be prepared. Of course, you then have to have training routines, and they're more or less opaque to us. We don't actually know exactly what they did, but we imagine that they included weapons drill and the ability to move together with other people in a close order, what's called phalanx fighting. So they'd be practicing, obviously, with wooden weapons rather than with edged iron weapons to avoid danger, to avoid injury.
Now, the Athenians were famous for pioneering form of democracy, but What about the Spartans then? What was their system of government? Because I've had a question here from the Gordon from Golden on Instagram, who asks, how did Sparta's dual monarchy work? So are we right in saying that Sparta was actually ruled by two kings drawn from different royal families? I mean, is that how things worked?
Yeah, yes and no. Dual monarchy is strictly inaccurate because monarchy means single rule, so one king. So it's a diarchy, and it is indeed in two aristocratic families, ultimately tracing their descent from Zeus via Heracles. This is what we call myth history. But at one point in the descent, twins were born, and the Spartans' belief in their past is that the two first joint kings were these two twins. They're called the Aegiads and the Eurypontids, but they didn't rule as monarchs or diarchs because they were severely hemmed in by all sorts of controls. One of them was that their main expression of their power came through a wider body. It was known as the Senate. It's a translation of the Greek word gerousia, of whom there were 30 members, two kings ex officio, regardless of their age. The other 28 were elected from men over 60, so beyond military age. And we think there was also a restriction in terms of birth. So in other words, it's an aristocratic elite body. And that body had the function of pre-deliberating. So anything that was put before the full assembly of all Spartan citizens, who met once a month on the seventh day of the month, the day devoted to Apollo, any motion put before that assembly for their yes or no vote, which they delivered by shouting, had to go first through the gerousia. So kings had authority. They could have charisma. They had terrific birth respect, and there were all sorts of customs. You mustn't touch a king. If you're in the presence of a king, you must stand up. The king can sit down, all that sort of thing. Kings had thrones, but on the other hand, they weren't executives. They weren't chief executives, except by delegation. So suppose the assembly, having been put the motion, do you want to go to war? And they say yes. So who's going to lead the army? Well, to begin with, two kings, two leaders. Unfortunately, at one point, end of the 6th century, in the 510s, it's about just before the end of the 6th century, as we call it, two kings went on a big campaign against Athens, fell out, and the campaign was a disastrous failure. Never again would both kings be on the same campaign, commanding the same troops ever again. So the king had this unique role as a commander of any army in the field. They were also priests, and Spartans were excessively, I mean, not just extremely, and all Greeks agreed on this, pious. They thought that anything to do with the gods, finding out what they wanted, how best they should be obeyed, what their will was, all that was much more important than what ordinary human beings thought about amongst themselves. And so they were constantly taking the will of the gods. They were consulting entrails. They were offering up prayers. They were sacrificing all that sort of stuff. Even when on the battlefield, they would slaughter an animal to see what its entrails said, whether or not they should actually advance to the fray or whether they should delay. So Spartans, extremely religious, and because the kings were priests, among other things, they were always central to the way the Spartans did things.
Great. Now, you mentioned earlier, Paul, that for this system to work, it had to have buy-in from Sparta's female population. And that leads me on to a question submitted by John Sharman. And it's quite a simple one. Is, were Spartan women the equals of men?
That's a very nice question. In one obvious political sense, no, and this was not unique to Sparta. It's the case in the whole of ancient Greece and indeed most of the world until the 19th century. Women had no political power whatsoever directly. In other words, any decision taken by the community, the state of the Spartans, no Spartan woman had the vote. However, and now this is where we have to be a little bit careful, because the mirage has an interest in exaggerating how much power informally Spartan women had, as opposed to the normal situation in Greece, which is that women have very little power or influence at all. Nevertheless, it does seem that Spartan girls, unlike girls in other Greek cities, though they didn't have an agoge in the way the boys did, though they continued to live at home until they were married, on the other hand, they were not just permitted, but encouraged to take physical exercise, to practice sorts of things that typically only boys did, such as wrestling, throwing the javelin. And the purpose of this, well, this is, of course, later sources. We don't know what the original motivation was, but later sources say this is to make women tough so that when childbirth comes along, they can better endure the pains of childbirth. And it is, we think it's a fact that many, many women in ancient Greece died giving birth for various reasons. And that, therefore, if the Spartan women were slightly more likely to survive childbirth than women in other cities, well, then that was a gain. The other side of Spartan upbringing for girls is to make them think in the way that their male counterparts were encouraged to, were brought up to. In other words, to embrace the ideals of the Spartan state: communal, self-denying, austere, and also powerful, military. Now, the stories that are told, put into the mouths, indeed, of Spartan women later, these possibly could all be made up. But there's a famous saying that a Spartan mother, as her son departs, or as her husband departs for battle, she says to him, "Come back either with it or on it," meaning, come back victorious with your shield, which is the key item of defensive armor that a Spartan warrior would use, or dead and on top of the shield carried by your comrades. Actually, Spartans were buried on the battlefield. They weren't brought back home. So the saying is no doubt made up. The point is, the Spartan mother, the Spartan wife, is as keen on the Spartans going to war as the Spartan males are supposed to be themselves. And then there is a most extraordinary, I think it probably is a fact, we're actually given a historical instance. Sparta has lost a battle. This is, of course, very, very unusual. The female relatives of the men who had died in that defeat are thrilled that their relatives have died in the cause for Sparta gloriously, though actually it's not so gloriously because they've lost the battle. Whereas the relatives of the survivors are miserable as sin that their relatives have survived. Well, now that is counterintuitive. It's exactly the opposite of what you'd expect in any normal human community. Is it true? Have the Spartans been so educated, the women as well as the men, to embrace values that are really quite counterintuitive and very abnormal? Well, one's tempted to think yes.
Now, a question that's very popular among internet search queries relates to the helots, and people want to know, how cruel was the Spartan treatment of its subjugated population?
So helots, I can now tell you, means captives. And imagine you're a member of a population which by birth, it's not your choice, you've not done anything yourself, it's just that your parents were captives and you are a captive from birth. Not brilliant, I would say. In other words, you're Greek, you worship some of the same gods, goddesses, heroes, heroines as your masters. There is therefore a psychological cruelty, regardless of any physical cruelty. But it is, of course, the physical cruelty, I'm guessing, that this questioner has in mind. However, I would mention to him this one interesting detail, that the Helots were, because they're not Spartans, they're not, of course, going through the agoge, but Spartan life in Sparta couldn't happen without the Helots. So Spartan wives need Helot women to bake the bread and to weave the clothes that they, the Spartan women, do not bake or weave. Spartan men, when they're eating in the daily mess meal, which is compulsory, it's an evening meal, well, somebody's got to cook it and somebody's got to serve it, and that's the Helots. Well, there's a story that it was the practice of the Spartans to get certain Helots, obviously not all of them, the Helots who are serving in the messes, as we call the evening dining groups, get the Helots blind drunk. Now, the Spartans themselves drank a great deal. They drank their wine mixed, typically, so that it wasn't that strong. You could drink quite a lot before you got very drunk. And the idea, of course, if you're a Spartan male, is you remain in control. Even if you're a little bit tipsy, you're still not blind drunk. They made Helots blind drunk, allegedly, and then showed them off to the young boys going through the agoge, who would be invited to come along and look. This is what a blind drunk person out of control looks like. Well, that to me is an extreme form of psychological cruelty. But there is one, and this may be what the questioner particularly had in mind in terms of physical cruelty. Do you remember I mentioned the in-between stage of a Spartan boy's life cycle? So from 7 to 18, he's in the agoge. 18, he graduates. But between 18 and 20, there's this interim period. Well, selected boys aged 18 and 19 were empowered, in fact, they were required to go off into the countryside. And I think that probably means across Taygetos into Messenia. And at night, if they came upon a Helot, were simply to murder him, probably him rather than her. So it was a kind of manhood test for the Spartan youth, adolescent. On the other hand, it was a terror mechanism for the Spartan state. If you as a Helot could be just randomly bumped off in the night without warning because you were a Helot. Well, if we believe that, and I think I probably do believe that, the Spartan system was exceptionally cruel. I would say not just cruel, but exceptionally cruel. So anything that said, and I'm going to say some positive things about Sparta, anything you say has to be qualified by the knowledge that that is the backdrop against which all Sparta's attainments abroad were happening.
Now, it's obviously impossible to talk about the Spartans without mentioning the Battle of Thermopylae, which, of course, inspired the film 300. So, Lorraine Clark asks, how remarkable was Spartan resistance at the battle?
Well, the first point I suppose to make is that the battle was in fact a defeat. It's one of those oddities that this battle, which the Spartans themselves made a big deal of, but has become associated in the popular mind, thanks to movies, but not only movies, with Spartan achievement of a positive kind, actually was a defeat. Now, it was an inevitable defeat. The Persians, huge army, multi-ethnic, for various reasons, decided in the early 5th century they wanted to extend their empire to the west, to include in it what is now, what was then, mainland Greece. And that means mainly taking on Athens and Sparta. But there were altogether something like 700 different Greek political communities, not just two, in the area that the Persians wanted to advance, to conquer, to add to their empire. However, if there was to be any resistance at all, it was absolutely crucial that Athens, the most powerful city by sea, and Sparta, the most powerful Greek city by land, should unite. Sparta, because of its Peloponnesian League alliance, was more powerful than Athens, and it was the senior partner in the alliance which was formed in the late 480s to resist the Persian invasion. And so this is the context in which the first resistance, the first actual encounter of what we call the Greco-Persian Wars, took place at Thermopylae, because if you're an army coming down from the north, as the Persian army was, from Macedonia through Thessaly into central Greece and then to Athens, you have to go through the pass of Thermopylae. 1 kilometre long, much closer to the sea then than it is today, because there's been various earth movements since 480 BC. So the extraordinary first thing about the battle is that the Spartans took the lead in ensuring that there was a resistance when many Greek cities were defeatist. Some actually went over to the Persian side because they were confident that the Persians would win and they didn't want to be on the losing side and punished if they lost. So the fact that Sparta took the lead, sent one of its two kings, Leonidas, I'm going to come back to him, is in itself remarkable. Then what about the actual so-called battle? Well, it was a series of battles. Over a week, the Persians camped outside the western end of the pass and waited for the Spartans and their allies. There were about 6,000 to 7,000, not just the 300 bodyguard of Leonidas. There were more Greeks than just that. Waited for them to surrender. And they didn't. And so after 3 days, the fighting began. It went on for another 3 days. And it was on the third day, through treachery as well as through sheer numbers, the Persians did eventually win. And so the sacrifice which the Spartans in particular made, together with some of their allies, Greek allies, that was the first thing that stood out when other Greeks were rather pathetically rolling over, certainly not resisting. The Spartans, the Athenians and their allies resisted. The fleet was stationed not far away from Thermopylae. It's very important to remember Persian army is coming down by land. The Persian fleet is coming down by sea. They have to be resisted at sea as well as on land. So there's a combined operation between Thermopylae and a place called Artemision at the very north of the island of Euboea. And the combination has the effect of holding up the Persians and inflicting on them severe casualties and therefore raising morale. And it's as a morale victory that Thermopylae was used by the Spartans and other Greeks. It was in practical terms a physical defeat.
Now, the other military engagement for which I guess Sparta is most famously involved was the Peloponnesian War. I just wonder if you could just give us a brief resume of how that came about and what impact the Peloponnesian War had on, you know, the Greek city-states going forward.
Thank you. Another nice question. We call it the Peloponnesian War because it's the war against the Peloponnesians looked at from the Athenian point of view. I myself call it the Athena-Peloponnesian War, just to remind us that it's a war between the allies of Athens and the allies of Sparta, the Peloponnesians. It breaks out chiefly because the Athenians are frustrated by what seems to them to be the Spartans' interference in what they would like to consider their sphere. They had collaborated and cooperated against Persia. They very soon fell out over who was most responsible for defeating the Persians. Was it the Spartans or was it the Athenians? And each of them could put forward good arguments. After that war, the Persian Wars, as we call them, the Spartans withdrew from any overseas activity in the Aegean being the sea between Menon, Greece, and the Persian Empire of Asia. And in that period, the Athenians built up a very large naval alliance. We speak of it as the Athenian Empire. So what comes to be is a struggle between the Spartans and their Peloponnesian allies by land, end, and the mainly naval alliance of the Athenians breaks out in 431 and lasts for almost a generation, 431 to 404, with a period of peace in the middle of it from 421 to 414, 413. And the Spartans win, partly because they are particularly good by land, but actually there wasn't that much head-to-head fighting in the Peloponnesian War. They win partly and significantly because the Persians are more afraid of Athens than they are of Sparta. And so it's in their interest that Athens lose. So the Persians start supplying Sparta with money. The Spartans use that money to buy ships, to buy people to sail them, and they eventually are able to confront the Athenians, and the Athenians finally get defeated in 405-404. And there's a kind of reversal, therefore. Sparta, the land power, defeats Athens, the sea power, on the sea, leaving Sparta top dog in the entire Greek world. And you asked, what going forward was the impact? Well, the war had been extremely long, very vicious. Many people had died. Civil war, that is, fighting within Greek cities, had occurred, including at Athens. Democracy had been the flourishing system at Athens. Persians weren't keen on democracy. The Spartans weren't keen on democracy. So that meant the end, temporarily, of democracy at Athens. Athens became, well, both impoverished and dominated by Sparta for about a decade. Then it turned out the Spartans thought they got a bit too big for their boots. Well, there are Greeks still in the Persian Empire. Now, this is not good. We must try to liberate them. And they started attacking the Persians in Asia by land, whereupon the Persians obviously thought, well, maybe we should switch our support back to the Athenians. And so they did, and they started sending money to Sparta's enemies, whereupon there was a 10-year or so conflict, at the end of which the Spartans emerged as again the greatest power. We're in the 380s BC, but their power had been, if you like, tempered. Well, for various reasons, very complicated, Spartans abused their position of power from the middle of the 380s and generated a very, very strong resistance from one city in particular, Thebes. And at a major battle in the late 370s, 371, Thebes defeated Sparta. And as I've said already, that was really the end of Sparta as a great power. For various reasons, Sparta's citizen numbers had declined to under 1,000, whereas at the time of the Persian Wars, there had been 8,000 a century later. We don't know exactly why this is, but nevertheless, Sparta was very, very much weakened internally, and it lost its Peloponnesian League alliance. It ceased to be a major player. So that's the immediate consequences of the Peloponnesian War.
Thank you, Paul. Now, through the span of Spartan history, I'm sure there would have been lots and lots of very, very important people who did a lot to shape the trajectory of this city-state. But I wonder if, quite quickly, you could maybe identify three characters in the history of Sparta that our listeners should know about.
Yes, I'm going to choose Lycurgus, Leonidas, and Agesilaus II. They're all in some way elite. Two of them are kings, which indicates the significance that a Spartan king could have. Lycurgus is the man credited by everybody, this is not just a sort of unique ascription, with introducing the fundamentals of the Spartan way of life. So their legal code, the relations between Spartans and Helots, the importance of the military, the educational system, treatment of women, all these are ascribed to Lycurgus. Now, we very sceptical modern historians wonder whether it's possible for a legislative package ever to come into being all at one go, and then to be as effective and as unchanged as the Spartans like to think. So we tend to think of a more gradual evolution of Spartan institutions, with different bits of it, the military, the religious, the social, developing at different times until you get to the 6th century, and then you have the Sparta. But nevertheless, there is a sense in which having a founding father served as a kind of cement, a way of everybody can get behind. He's not a controversial figure. He's the great wise founder of distant times. But thanks to him, it's mainly thanks to him, we are who we are and what we are. Leonidas, everyone probably who knows anything about Thermopylae will know a little bit, at any rate, about him. He was about 60 when he was called upon, and I think he was not just called upon, but he called himself forward. I think he made a big pitch for being the king who was sent to Thermopylae, and who indeed possibly manipulated an oracle. And there's a famous one which says that if a king dies for Sparta, then Sparta will be saved. And I think Leonidas said, put me forward, I'll go to Thermopylae, I'll lead the troops. It's not at all sure that we're going to survive, that we're going, certainly not at all sure we're going to win, but I will make a sacrifice on behalf of Sparta and of Greece. And the 300 he chose, very interestingly, not his usual royal bodyguard. There was a royal bodyguard, men in their 20s. They were the royal bodyguard of each of the two kings. He chose 300 specially, men who already both were married and had fathered a living son. So there's some point here about the future, that these 300 won't necessarily survive Thermopylae, but their children will come up to avenge them and to be their successors, as it were. And I think, therefore, Leonidas deserves enormous credit for the psychological warfare as well as the physical bravery that he displayed. And then my third example is slightly more controversial. He's called Agesilaus. He was a king of the other house. Leonidas was an Aegead. Agesilaus is a Eurypontid. He reigned for 40 years. He was lame in one leg, which is unusual for a Spartan to be allowed to survive if you're not perfect at birth. And yet he went through the agoge with apparently acclaim, and he was therefore more Spartan, more like your average Spartan than kings typically were. On the other hand, I believe, this is my own view, that his foreign policy was almost from word go a disaster. He was one of those sort of Spartan imperialists of a very aggressive kind who believed in rubbing the noses of other Greeks in the dust, as it were, and triumphantly parading Sparta as the greatest. And so instead of pursuing alliances and diplomacy, he pursued aggression, in particular against Thebes. He had a particular bugbear with the Thebans, which that didn't do Sparta or their position in Greece any good whatsoever, because it was the Thebans that dealt the coup de grace that really put an end to Sparta as a great power. He reigned from 400 or so to 360 BC. He died in North Africa at the age of 84, and there is a Life of Him by Plutarch. If you read that in conjunction with the Life of Lycurgus that Plutarch wrote, you'll see just how Lycurgan Spartan Agesilaus was. If you want to know what it's like to be a Spartan of the classical period, Agesilaus's life is a good one to read.
That was Paul Cartledge, historian and the author of books including The Spartans, An Epic History. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.